The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We're going to bring you another Best of the Book Nook today, and we're going to revisit an interview I did back in 2001, talking about a biography of the guy who invented the jet airplane engine. His name was Hans von Ohain, and he invented it during the late 1930s in Germany. And then, after the war, he came to Wright-Patterson, where he was part of Operation Paperclip. That's coming up in the Book Nook, but first we need to bring you the news from NPR. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. 25 years ago, I did a live interview with a woman who had just written a biography of Hans von Ohain. Have you ever heard of him? He was the inventor of the jet airplane engine, and he came from Germany after World War II and continued his work at Wright-Patterson as part of Operation Paperclip. In 2001, Margaret Connor published his biography, Elegance in Flight. And she brought some people with her during this interview. She had a special guest who joined us in studio. A big surprise awaits you on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today we have a very special book to talk about. It was written by Margaret Connor, and it is called Elegance in Flight. It's a biography of Hans von Ohain, who was the co-inventor of the jet engine. And he spent many years at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, I hope that you don't call it co-inventor. He did it all on his own.
I see it says right here on your book, co-inventor.
Oh, now, who? No, who? He was all alone in Germany as a young student. Uh-huh. And had this wonderful idea in his brain. He was working on his PhD on an entirely different subject. And he said, I can do this. And so he played and played.
Now, Margaret, our listeners heard another voice when I introduced you. Could you introduce our other guest?
Please meet Hani von Ohain, who is the widow of Dr. von Ohain, who is visiting here from Melbourne, Florida. Hani, say hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
This is really a treat. Hans grew up in Germany, and at a very early age, he decided that he was going to do something about those noisy airplanes. Tell us about this. Tell us about the story of this.
Well, he went up in a commercial flight in 1930 in a Fokker trimotor, and there was so much noise and vibration that he said, you can't even hold a conversation on a plane. He said, a plane should fly with elegance. It should be quiet. And so, of course, he worked in his mind and on paper until the poor young man decided the only way he could convince anyone of his wonderful idea was to build a prototype. And that's where it started.
Tell us about his family.
Oh, well, he had a very handsome older brother who was a straight-A student. And Hans wasn't a very good student until he got into high school and suddenly discovered that he did have some intelligence. And he had a younger brother, 10 years younger, that, interestingly enough, he kept the name Pabst because Hans' full name was Hans Joachim Pabst von Ohain.
And the name Pabst is connected to...
It's a family name.
the beer that we all know here in this country. There's a connection. There's a relation.
Yes.
Great uncles came to United States. I think Milwaukee, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And he married one of the Pabst. Pabst, yes. Who had the company Pabst Blue Ribbon here. Uh-huh.
So there we have the connection with beer. And when we think of Germany, we think of good beer. We also think about wonderful science and a lot of brilliant thinkers in Germany. And this gentleman who ran this company that Hans connected with was a real key in the story, wasn't he?
Well, I think Ernst Haeckel was a key indeed, because he was very wealthy, had his own aircraft airframe company. Hans decided not to go to an engine company with his prototype because they would laugh him out. They were so happy with a reciprocating engine that he went to an airframe manufacturer. He also liked to be up near Rostock, up on the Baltic, because he wanted to have a sailboat, and he loved to sail. So he thought, well, I can work for him. But Ernst Haeckel was very wealthy and provided the funds for Hans to fully develop an engine until it flew. The only problem with Haeckel was that he just drove this young man. Hans was 24 when he took his drawings under his arm, carried them into the Mr. Haeckel, and said, I can change your business. Haeckel said, go ahead, young man. But he'd call him every day and say, make any progress today?
And it was all done in secret. He kept it from the air ministry, the German air ministry, until the plane was finished.
And this was in the late 30s. Mm-hmm. And Hans came up with these ideas pretty much on his own. And he was one of the few men of his age that had an automobile at the time, because he was a student. He had an automobile. And there was a gentleman who helped him with his car. And they formed a relationship which continued.
He was a mechanic.
My favorite story is that they always called each other by the formal names, even though they were working in grease and moving parts and everything like that. But they were always very formal, because this was Dr. von Ohain and Herr Hahn. And they kept this relationship even after they both went to Haeckel and worked for Haeckel, always a formal relationship in Germany at the time.
Well, what happened, if I understand it, is Hans went to Mr. Haeckel and then said, look, I've been working with this man who's a mechanic in this automobile shop, mm-hmm. and he is someone very important to me. He understands what I'm trying to do, and he got him a job with Mr. Haeckel.
Hans always appreciated those that helped him, and he always gave credit, and he would say, oh, this man helped me so much, this man helped me so much. And all through his career, unfortunately, Hans didn't take a lot of credit to himself. And I think this is the disappointment that people don't know him today as they should know him, because he did this wonderful work himself. With the help of other people. He always gave credit to everyone else rather than taking it himself.
And he was clearly a visionary, because people in a lot of countries had thought about this type of technology, but they'd sort of discarded it. Tell us about what was going on at the same time in the United States and in places like England.
Well, let's look at England. There was a young man who was a pilot in England. He became Sir Frank Whittle. He had the idea and did drawings and got a patent in 1930 for a jet engine, entirely different from the von Ohain engine. Whittle did not have the money to build an engine. He did not get his engine to fly until 1941, nearly 2 years after Hans' engine flew. The interesting story about what happened with the Americans, they used Theodore von Karman as their advisor in such items of national interest, and he was in a meeting with the Navy. And they brought up the idea that this was 1938. Maybe we ought to look into jet propulsion. And von Karman said, oh, no, let's leave it. let's leave it, let's not pursue it. But then when General Hap Arnold found out that Whittle was working on an engine and had flown one in 1941, this was, of course, during the war, they jumped on it right away and brought the Whittle engine to the United States. And the roots of our jet engine in the United States did start with Whittle's engine until von Ohlheim came to the United States in 1947 as a paperclip scientist.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling, going back to an interview I did 25 years ago with Margaret Connor. And we were talking about a scientist who worked at Wright-Patterson. He came over from Germany after the war and was part of Operation Paperclip. Do you remember those scientists who came over? There was a rush between the Russians and the Americans to try to get those scientists out of Germany after the fall of the Third Reich. And one of them, the Americans got, was the inventor of the jet engine, Hans von Ohlheim. And as you might have noticed, his wife, Hani von Ohlheim, was there to be part of this interview, and we'll continue with it right after this.
Great.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Back in 2001, I interviewed Margaret Connor for her biography of the inventor of the jet engine. It was called Elegance in Flight, and his name was Hans von Ohlheim.
The war happened, and Hans was working for Mr. Heinkel in his factory. And before the war happened, before the U.S. was drawn into the war, we think about the war as when the U.S. was drawn in Pearl Harbor. But there was a lot of stuff going on before that in Europe, the invasion of Poland, Czechoslovakia, a lot of things like that. And suddenly, the German war effort goes into overdrive. But they really didn't appreciate this invention, did they?
Let me say that I think the critical thing about the lack of publicity about Hans' engine was that his engine flew on August 27th, 1939. This was 5 days before Hitler invaded Germany. And so all of a sudden, they didn't want any information. Or Hitler invaded Poland. Yes, thank you.
We honey. All knew what you meant.
Yes, Hitler didn't, yeah. But anyway, oh, well. The troops were all lined up on the border, and all the world attention was, what is Hitler going to do with all these troops lined up? Nobody was paying attention to a silly invention like a jet engine. So it did not get publicized in the world press. It took many years for people to find out that the Germans were so successful, not just the Heinkel Company, but Junkers and BMW. Many of the engine companies got into the jet propulsion research during World War II.
This is a very difficult time, too. I think it needs to be pointed out that so many of these scientists were forced to be involved in the war effort, and a lot of them were forced to do things that perhaps their consciences rebelled against. Hans was fortunate that he was working for Mr. Heinkel and was protected from some of this, but he did have some bad experiences, didn't he?
Yes. One experience, he said that because he didn't look blonde, like I guess on television he was portrayed as a blue-eyed blonde recently in the ME 262 film, but he was dark-haired, dark-eyed, and when his arm did not go up fast enough as he was walking down the street in the Nazi salute, he was knocked down, and they said, oh, you know, you are not a true German. You are not a true follower.
Let's talk about the first use of the engine. Give us some background. Tell us about when they figured out it was going to work and then how they tested it.
Okay. Well, they did test it under another aircraft. And I guess the amazing thing was they would take it up with a reciprocating engine on a regular plane. And when it was flying along, then they would cut in the jet engine, and they would see their plane take off. It was amazing. But after the first flight, there was a big effort to turn this into an engine to propel a jet fighter. And so the next effort was an engine that had a successful, it was the first successful flight of a fighter with a jet engine. Unfortunately, they had some problems with that engine. And so the Junkers jet engine was the one that propelled the ME-262, which was such a threat to American forces, to the Allied forces during the war. They would be flying along, you know, in formation to go in to bomb Germany, and all of a sudden something would go whoosh, and they'd say, "What was that?" A couple of minutes later, it would come back the other way, whoosh, it would go by, and they'd say, "What was that?" And it was the ME-262 jet plane that scared everybody to death. But Hans really did not get an engine supporting any German aircraft by the end of the war.
We're getting a lot of interesting sound effects, your jet sounds. And then when you touch the microphone stand, it sounds like we're in a submarine. So we're getting all those wartime sound effects here. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Margaret Connor wrote the book Hans von Ohain, Elegance in Flight. We're moving through history now. We're in the war years. And these scientists, a lot of them realize, we're getting a great history lesson in this book. A lot of them realize that the German war effort is doomed. And as we get to the end of the war, suddenly it's a race between the Soviets and the U.S. and other countries to try to get to these scientists first as the Nazi war effort is collapsing and Germany ultimately surrenders. Give us some background.
With Hans, he was bombed out several times and moved from location to location. Finally, he realized that there was no reason to continue to set up another factory because the Americans were around the corner and the Soviets were coming that way. And he said they sort of dragged their feet to do anything. And he would see the American planes flying over and knew that it was just a matter of a short time. And at the very end, the edict came down from Berlin that they should burn anything that could be an asset to the Americans. In a quote that I read, he said, "We were so glad because we couldn't get those engines to work, and we knew if we could rebuild them from scratch that we could make them better. So," he said, "we just burned those engines, and when the Americans came in after the end of the war, we were given the privilege through the Navy to rebuild some engines to demonstrate to the Americans our success with the HESO-11 engine.
Here in Dayton, we're very competitive with North Carolina over the Wright brothers. I must say I chuckled when I read the book, and you had a quote from some German scientist, I can't remember who was scoffing at the Wright brothers and said that they were fakes. Who was it? I'm trying to remember. You wrote the book. Just kidding. That's okay. She's drawing a blank here. The book is Elegance in Flight. It's the story of Hans von Ohain. We have the situation at the end of the war where they're rushing to get these scientists. And one scientist who was very knowledgeable offered his services to the Americans. And they said, "Oh, we've already got enough of you guys." And he ended up going over to the Soviets. Hans was very fortunate. He ended up going over to the Americans. Tell us about Operation Paperclip.
Oh, you will love this. The way that they identified who would be cleared to come to the United States after going through all their previous work history and their affiliation or non-affiliation with the Nazi Party, they put a paperclip on their file. And soon it was called the Paperclip Operation. And the scientists, I think 167 came to Wright-Patt in many disciplines, from human resources, mathematics, particularly in propulsion because it was an Air Force effort, but they came to Wright-Patt. It's interesting, Hans came over without any particular recognition except that he was a good scientist. And suddenly he was identified. Cliff Simpson, who had interviewed him in Germany, was looking over the list one day and said, do you know who we have at Wright-Patt? We've got Hans von Ohain. Everybody said, oh, who's Hans von Ohain? And they said, well, he just incidentally invented the jet engine. And they said, oh, let's get him. So he had a very important assignment within a very short time after he arrived at Wright-Patt, working at Arnold Engineering Development Center at Tullahoma.
Hans sounds like a man who didn't like to blow his own horn. He didn't like to boast. And now we get to the section here where these scientists are in the Dayton area. They're homesick. They miss the good food back home. They're looking for a place to get some of those good German sausages. Where did they go? Mrs. von Ohain, do you have any thoughts on that?
This is your story.
Well, they came to my father had a grocery store, but he made German lunch meat, and that's where they came. And that's where I met Professor Otto Walschner, and he is the man who brought Hans to our house for Christmas dinner 1947.
And you lived on a farm, is that right?
We lived on the farm.
And where is that now? Where is the farm?
In Brookville.
Okay.
It was. It's not there. They made a park out of it now.
Okay. And you had no idea that this man had made this invention, did you?
No. He never talked about himself, not about technical things. But it was on our wedding day. Professor Walschner was my husband's best man, and that's when he got up and spoke. Hans built the first jet engine, and we were all surprised, especially me.
And he moved his parents here, is that right?
Yes, they came 1 year later, his parents and his brother and his family.
They never thought he'd get married, did they?
No, Hans was almost just about 38 years old when we got married.
He was married to his work. He was married to his science.
He was. He was.
And then
there was no time for anything else.
But you came along, didn't you?
Well, yes, but that was after the plane was built.
That was such a wonderful story. I love that.
The interesting thing, I guess, when the scientists got here, they were used to working in Germany 12-hour days, 16-hour days. And all of a sudden, they were working at Wright-Patt, and they said, you will work 8-hour days and a half day on Saturday. And they had so much time, they didn't know what to do with it. And so that's when they got out and socialized. And that's when the cake and coffee out at the Schuchat's farm became a very popular thing.
Yeah, Mother baked a cake every Saturday afternoon. And we had people come. They were not invited. They just came. And we loved it. We loved company.
What kind of cakes did she make?
German cakes. Torts, apple cake, plum cake.
I can see why they were coming. And you were there too, right?
Well, of course.
And Honey would play the piano and sing. Honey's a very talented singer and had quite a singing career in Dayton. And, of course, she was singing the lovely German songs that they knew from their days in Germany. And this brought warm feelings to all these scientists. So she won the hearts of all these scientists. But I think particularly Hans.
Tell us about AIAA, the people that commissioned the book. Do you know?
They did. No, the book was actually commissioned by the Air Force.
Okay.
And was actually built through the efforts of Universal Technology in Dayton, Ohio. I had a lot of help from many scientists from the base. There was a man at the base who never threw anything away about Hans because he really admired him so much. Marv Stibbick has just recently retired.
What a gold mine.
But Marv brought over stacks and stacks of stuff and said, well, go through it. There might be some stuff in here. And it was wonderful.
And Margaret, you worked with Hans, is that
yes.
right?
I knew him through Honey. Oh, I have to tell the story. Honey and I used to sing together. And because she's short and pretty, she was the girl and wore a dirndl. And I, because I'm taller, I would wear the lederhosen, and we sang the German light opera songs. I mean, at the time, whenever anybody would say, would you like to sing for us, we would immediately go.
That was for music club.
Well, and also for church groups.
Well, you're begging the question, Margaret. We've got a lot of people out there listening. Right now they're all saying, will you sing for us?
No.
But you always used to say yes.
Oh, yes, yes.
You haven't
but
practiced
we're older.
Yet.
Yes, yes. The years have slipped by.
Can't you do just one, just little snatch? They're thinking about it.
No, no.
Okay, well, I tried.
Du liest mir in Herzen.
Wien nur du allein.
Can we get a translation, please? We're talking about the biography of Hans von Ohain, Elegance in Flight. Margaret Connor wrote it, and we've been joined in studio by Hani von Ohain as well. Okay, right, we're at Wright Air Base now.
Yeah. Oh.
Tell us about what happened there. So many more things happened at Wright.
When Hans arrived at Wright-Patterson, he was, of course, singled out to move ahead and help with the development of the compressor that they were working on at AEDC, but he soon made such major contributions in the scientific line that the years, of course, clicked by after, say, 1953, and he finally was asked by his colonel if he would be chief scientist for the aerospace research lab. And he said, I couldn't do that. I'm a physicist. And the man said, but that's what we want. So he was leader in research. Among all the researchers there, he was the chief scientist for Aerospace Research Lab, fondly remembered by many alumni of the group because they did such really exciting, innovative things. After that, when funding and national priorities changed, he went to the Air Force Aero Propulsion Lab as chief scientist, and he retired from there. But he made such significant contributions as both leader and indeed advisory scientist that he is remembered as quite a genius.
I think one of my favorite stories in the book, there's a story about these scientists, and they would go on business trips, they would travel around the country, and their per diem wasn't very much. They didn't give them very much money. So these guys decided, look, we're scientists. We're very smart guys. We found a way that we're going to economize. We're going to go to this place where we have this meeting, and we're going to buy the cheapest car that we can find, and we'll drive it around. Whenever it breaks down, we'll fix it, and that'll save us a lot of money. And finally, at the end, the car completely falls apart as they're going to the airport, and they park it by the airport fence and climb over the fence and leave it. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
Yes, you're doing a beautiful job. I love this, yes.
So, give us some more detail about that story.
Yeah. Well, when you think of the gentlemen involved, they were very top scientists. I think Hans was one of the more agile ones to climb the 6-foot fence, but who knows, in California that car could still be sitting beside the highway.
But I can guarantee you, you can't climb the fence at an airport anymore and run to the plane.
Right.
Wow. I chuckled when I read that. And this book is so meticulously researched. It has so much great information, so much history. And he also was affiliated with the University of Dayton, was he not?
Yes, he was a professor there. I can't remember.
And also, he was with the University of Dayton Research Institute and as a consultant and worked also at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington as a consultant and advisor for a year. This was after his formal retirement. He just never gave on investigating.
He was also a professor at the University of Florida in Gainesville during the winter months. We drove down with the dog and I in one car and he in the other car. Two cars we drove down.
So you had a winter home
in
Florida?
We were there. No, we did not. We stayed in the professor's home. He was on a sabbatical.
Okay.
So we stayed in his house. But we had that was really nice being down there. That was only for 3-4 months at a time. For 3 years, we did that.
And you lived in Centerville, and I understand that it was a very hospitable place to visit where you lived, your home.
Yes.
I understand that people loved coming over.
Well, we loved having them.
This book really captures his personality and his genius. It's an amazing story. Now, after World War II, when they came in to get these scientists, the first scientists that they were looking for were rocket scientists, people like Wernher von Braun, mm-hmm. who he knew.
Yes. Yeah.
They weren't exactly friends, though, were they?
No, but they knew. They respected each other. And then
the second tier that they went after were guys like him. Now, why did they go for the rocket people first? Is it because they knew more about rockets?
No, because I think it was the Russian threat at the time. The Russians grabbed off all the rocket specialists that they could possibly get, kidnapping them if they could. But the United States knew that this was very important. Well, with the V-2 rocket that they had lobbed across to England, they knew that the technology was quite advanced. I think they suddenly realized that they needed to get up to date on jet propulsion also, and that was the second rank of people that they brought.
Well, I don't think there's a person out there listening who hasn't been influenced by his invention. It's really changed our lives, hasn't it? The jet engine.
I hope that people remember his name because I want to say, too, that in later years, he and Frank Whittle became good friends. And Frank Whittle was brought to Dayton, and at one point, Hans and Sir Frank did a seminar at Wright-Patt and then a seminar for the general public that people could come in and hear them talk about how they built their respective engines. The two men became very close friends and would talk regularly and commiserate about the problems they had.
And there's a photo of them together in the book. So as we celebrate the centennial of flight next year in Dayton and the Wright brothers, we need to bear in mind that Dayton continued to be very important in flight and in invention and in creation of science for advanced flight. What are some of the other inventions that he was involved with? They're also in your book. She's blank.
They're in the book. I am not a technical person. I have an awful lot of help, and I had stacks of paper that I would read about VTOL and VSTOL. He was most fascinated with the vertical takeoff and landing. That was one of the things. But all the technology that went into propulsion beyond just the engine.
You're talking about like the Harrier?
Takeoff? And the Harrier has been successful. The most interesting thing, his first idea back when he was just a kid, he thought that a jet engine could be made with no moving parts. And his last thought, he said, before I die, I think I can invent a jet engine with no moving parts. And he worked and worked and worked on it and must have had scientific papers on it, but he never did achieve that. So somewhere out there, there is a scientist who might be able to do that, maybe someone in Dayton, Ohio.
So we were left with another inspiration, another invention perhaps possible in his mind that he just didn't get to. A lot of times when I read books like this, they're a little too dry for me, but this wasn't just all about inventions. This was about a man, about a life, about history of our century. Just incredible stories. We see what happened in Germany during World War II. We see the collapse of the German war effort. And we see these scientists being drawn out of Germany and headed off to other places. A lot of them went to the Soviet Union, didn't they?
Yes. unfortunately. And like you said, the one man who was considered.
They were kidnapped. They didn't want to go.
Well, it's a wonderful story, and we really appreciate you coming down. And we're not alone in the studio. We also have Bill McCuddy here taking photos, and Bill is from the base. And this has been quite a day in the Book Nook, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Don't touch that dial. We've got a bonus segment coming up for you right after this. Welcome to your bonus segment on WYSO for the Book Nook. And as regular listeners are aware, occasionally I diverge from literary fare to musical recordings that I made back when I hosted music shows on WYSO. And a number of years ago, I was joined in studio by one of my favorite songwriters, a very literary guy who shares my Iowa background. His name is Dan Byrne, and he played some songs for us that day. I hope you enjoy these on the best of the Music Nook.
Dan, this is a new thing for you, having a band, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of a new thing. I mean, I've taken bands out on the road before. This is the first time we've done a tour of the same people two times in a row. Uh-huh. And it's the same band that's on the record. So, yeah, I mean, it's feeling more and more like a band, and that's a new thing. I hate it, but it's great.
These guys seem like pretty pleasant guys. Who are they?
Well, basically, they're really good drivers. Incredibly good drivers. Will Massack got us here from Ann Arbor in illegal time today. And Spanky Mahoney plays drums and drives. And Slim Nickel plays bass and drives. And Eben Grace plays guitar and drives. And Shark just drives and does sound, and that's us.
Well, you're a long way from Mount Vernon and Stone City.
Indeed. What do you know about Stone City?
I know a few things about Stone City.
That's dangerous.
We'd love to hear a song. I'm Grant Wood's nephew, just kidding.
Little Iowa humor.
Want to play a song for us?
Sure, sure. I didn't know that was a lead into a... Sure. I'm stunned slightly. Yeah. This is a song that's on the record that we play pretty much every night, and I'm still not tired of it, and I don't know why, but I always liked playing it, so we'll play it again. It was written about 4 hours after the millennium turned. So that's probably all you need to know. It goes like this. Sitting in that town in after a game show, trying to decide if I should sell my van, buy a truck, drive down to Texas. Sometimes I think I'm gunning for the big time. Sometimes I think I'm running out of time. And that big odometer in the sky turned over. Yes, that big odometer in the sky just turned over. Lately I've been scattered. My attention span is like a 3-year-old. I pick up my guitar and I set it down. Try reading books. End up going downtown. My friends say relax, slow down. But my insides feel like a ghost town. Tumbling and blowing and all my
guts turned over like a tumbleweed through an empty town, turning over, turning over upside down. Someone's honor to protect. Maybe I go down and drink my fill. Maybe I can go sign someone's will. Out there in the alley, someone's trying to start their car, but that old thing ain't buying. Every time he tries, he scrapes the air. But that tired, crazy, she ain't barely turning over, turning over, turning over, turning over, turning over, upside down, blowing round and round and round. On the edge of town, where the wind meets a stillness, where the darkness meets the light, where the ocean meets the sky, the desert meets the rain, where the earth meets the heavens. On the edge of town, I met God. One thing for me, send me back in time, send me to Seattle, let me go find Kurt Cobain, take away his gun, take away his bullets. Talk to him, make him wanna live. Tell him how we love him, help him see his glory. God said no. He said no. If I sent you back, if you really found him, you would only ask him if he could help you get a deal, if he knows a lawyer, if he can help you. God said no. Let me go, let me go find Hitler. I will stalk him, I will bring him down. I will bring along a powerful gun loaded with bullets, obliterate his memory. God said no. If I send you back, you would get caught up in theory and discussion. You would let your fears delay and distract you. You would make friends, you would take a lover. God said no. Send me to Jerusalem. Let me go. Let me go find Jesus. Let me save his life as they try to kill him. Let me take him down, down from the cross. Take the iron from his body. Try to heal his wounds. If he really found him walking with the cross, you would stare, your tongue no longer working, eyes no longer seeing, ears no longer hearing. God said time, time belongs to me. Time's my secret weapon, my final advantage. God turned away from the edge of town. I knew I was beaten, and then now was all I had. God said no.
And that was Dan Byrne, recorded live in the WYSO studios about a quarter of a century ago. And that final song, what a powerful song by Dan Byrne. It was called God Said No. He had a fantasy about going and asking God if he could go back in time and change some things. He wanted to go back to Berlin and take care of Adolf Hitler. He said he wanted to obliterate his memory. Been hearing a lot of that verb lately, the word obliterate, coming out of another mouth of another leader. And some of us would like to obliterate that memory as well, but life goes on. We struggle on. We muddle through. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. My name's Vic McCunis. We'll bring you the Book Nook again tomorrow morning, entirely different show at 10:30 Sunday morning. And we'll be going back to 1997, my very first interview with Joseph Cannon and his first novel, Los Alamos. That's tomorrow morning at 10:30 right here on WYSO.